Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 51 of the show. If you're still here, it means you made it past the super annoying 50th episode celebration where I included sound effects. My hat's off to you for enduring that. I know it was kind of juvenile and annoying, and that was the point. That was what made it fun. Anyway, if you're still here, my hat's off to you. So welcome back to the show. First up, a little note of housekeeping. I know last week on the show I talked about how I was running a BookBub ad, and the week this episode 51 airs will be the week after that, but I'm actually recording it earlier. It's just after Thanksgiving here in real time, so I don't have results of my BookBub ad to share with you and the sale I'm running on all my other books for that week. But I will talk about that in an upcoming episode very soon. I will share how my BookBub did and lessons I learned from it. Anyway, so let's get back to what we're doing here, which is we're going to talk a little bit about some kind of tip of the week. Then we're going to read a chapter from The Problematic Virtue. And this week, I want to talk a little bit about beta readers. They have been, specifically in how to pick them, they have been one of the most useful tools that I have found in my career as an indie author. Because, and so let me just say as a caveat, disclaimer, warning, pre-speaking thingy, that if you are not making use of beta readers, you're not putting out a quality product. Because even if you have a professional editor, maybe you might even hire a developmental editor, you might hire a line editor, you might hire a proofreader, you can hire all those people, but you're not going to get the full extent of feedback you could get if you're making use of beta readers, because your beta readers are actually people out there who consume fiction. And now I've used beta readers who aren't writers, and I've used beta readers who are writers, and I like to have a mix of both whenever I contact beta readers for a new project. I usually like to get at least 10 people, because then probably about 5 of them will actually read the book, and that's usually good enough for me to get enough feedback. And I like to have a mix of writers and non-writers. Non-writers are great because they're not going to tell me what I need to do to fix the book. What I usually say is I don't really give real specific instructions when I'm sending beta reader copies out. I usually just say something like, tell me where it's confusing, tell me where the story moves too fast, where it moves too slow, or anything that sticks out to you that you don't like. And that's the only instruction I give, and usually a writer, if I've contacted a beta reader who's also an author, they'll send me feedback that's like, I didn't like this particular sentence. And that's fine, because authors are more likely to tell me what I need to do specifically to fix it. And that can be really useful sometimes, but the reader feedback, the real genuine beta reader non-author feedback, is good, because they'll just say, this part, I just didn't like it. I don't know what it is about it, but I just didn't like it. And then it's my job to go in there and fix it. And that's really useful, because no matter how many times you sit down and edit your book, you're going to eventually become blind to what needs to be fixed in it. And that's just the nature of the beast. And so you need other eyes. And I have a couple of beta readers that have read all my stuff, and they're really awesome for doing that. And because they know me, they know how I tell stories, they know what to expect from me, and so they know when something doesn't work. They know when I'm being lazy in my writing, and they can point that out. And I also like to try to do my best to engage a couple of new beta readers that I've never worked with before every time I put out a new product. And lately, the last few months, I've been focusing exclusively on my Micah Reed series. And so when you're writing a series, at least this is what I'm finding, it's even more important to have both kinds of beta readers, authors and non-authors, because, I mean, wait, that's not what I meant to say. It's important to have beta readers that I've worked with before and ones I haven't worked with before, because there are like those couple beta readers I mentioned who read everything I do. They've read I'm working on the third Micah Reed book right now, and when I give it out to beta readers, the two beta readers who've read book one and book two, they'll be able to look at it and tell me where the inconsistencies in Micah's character are. And then also, I want to engage people who haven't read the first two Micah Reed books because they are kind of standalone-y. I mean, it's a standalone in that the adventures, they're thriller books, and so each book is its own separate story. And I want a reader to be able to pick up anywhere in the series and enjoy them. But also, there is a character arc from Micah that goes over the entire series. So there's sort of both. But I want a reader who hasn't read books one and books two to be able to pick up book three, read it, and tell me where things were confusing because I didn't maybe include enough exposition. And there's a fine line there. I want to include just enough exposition that you can read that standalone novel and not feel lost, but not include too much exposition so that loyal readers of the series will feel like, yeah, I get this already. We've already been over this in the first couple books. And a lot of the struggle with beta readers is finding people who have time. You know, I said that I would contact 10 people and get 5 of them to read it. And maybe there's probably more like 7 or 8 people are going to read it. But usually I give people a time frame and I say, you know, I need feedback in 3 weeks or less, because I can't sit around for 6 months waiting for people to read my book and give me notes. You know, I've got to get on to the next thing. And so a lot of times people will read it, but it's much, much later, you know, sometimes after I publish the book. And that's great. I still appreciate them reading it, but those notes don't do me a whole lot of good anymore. So I guess the moral of the story here is to acquire a variety of beta readers, to also, you know, make sure that it's people you trust. You don't want to approach scandalous people who are going to maybe try to steal your book. Or publish it themselves, you know, give it away for free. But, you know, that's probably not something you need to worry about. I wouldn't go onto like a public forum somewhere and say, hey, I'm looking for beta readers. I would probably put it out to your social medias first and say, who among my friends list is interested in reading my book? Because those people are probably not going to steal your shit, even though, you know, you don't really have to worry about that too much. I think I talked a few episodes ago about piracy and how it's not something you really need to worry about. But so you want to get people that are going to give you useful feedback and quickly, and after you've done this a few times, you'll develop a list of people you know you can trust. So let's get on with our reading of The Problematic Virtue. Today we're going to be reading Part 3, Chapter 28, and after today there is only one more chapter in Part 3. Next week will be Chapter 29, and it's kind of exciting because there's a plot twist that hasn't, I'm pretty sure I haven't spoiled yet. So that's cool. But this week's chapter, I think, is pretty interesting. Got some nice tension. If you remember, it's an Alex chapter. And last time we saw Alex, he had just broken the news to Brian that Megan is Derek Wiles' brother's wife. And at the time, Alex said that he was not going to tell Wiles about it because he didn't want to see Brian get shot. So what we're reading today leads right into that, and then there's a scene break and a different scene with Alex, but here we go. 28. Alex. Despite the wheezing, coughing, and complete inability to catch his breath, they had played only 5 minutes. Alex and Wiles had gone to the court to shoot hoops after Wiles had launched on an angry tirade about the sedentary lifestyle. He said he needed a break from Xbox and bong hits. Alex quite liked Xbox and bong hits, but did as Wiles wished. Alex played point guard on his middle school basketball team and led his team to the state championships in 7th grade despite never trying exceptionally hard, but today he stepped on the court for the first time in years. He had shed his two long-sleeved shirts and now stripped down to his undershirt and sweatpants. "You're dripping with sweat, Britton," Wiles said. "When was the last time you got out and got some exercise?" "I hooked up with that brunette with the glasses from the bar the other night after you guys left," he said. "That was a real workout. Working on my fuck muscle, the most important one in the body. That's real game, not like this weak-ass game you're trying to bring against me out here today." He did not actually hook up with the brunette with the glasses, and apart from snowboarding once this season, he had not exercised in a long time. "Oh, is that right? And here I thought we were just warming up." "Well, come on then, let's see it, son," Wiles said, hunkering down and pushing up his sleeves. "You talk lots of shit, so let's do this." Alex dribbled twice, and then rolled left around Wiles, driving straight to the hoop. Wiles recovered quickly enough to give Alex a little bump from the side as he released the ball, causing Alex to bank a shot that went nowhere near the hoop. "Oh, that's embarrassing. I'll bet you weren't expecting that." "How does it make you feel?" Wiles said, giving Alex a round of slow clapping. "That's a foul, dude." Alex trudged after the ball and tossed it to Wiles. They faced off. Alex struggled to catch his breath, which made him lightheaded. Wiles looked left, faked right, and then spun left and rushed past Alex for the layup. Alex lumbered after the ball, grunting. Two dribbles in, he spotted up for a jumper when Wiles just grabbed the ball right out of his hands. Wiles dribbled and then held the ball, stopping play. He inspected the wheezing Alex. "Brian done anything weird lately? Just odd, unusual stuff? Had anybody over you don't recognize?" "How would I know? He's never at home anymore." "Does he look at you and then leave the room when he gets a phone call?" "No, I told you, dude, I hardly ever see the guy. Maybe 10 minutes a day. When I do see him, he's bitching about this thing or that thing or just moping about his brother running away." Then Wiles said something unusual. "Jimmy Connolly? He didn't run away. I know exactly where he is." Alex did not know how to interpret this statement. Wiles never offered insight into anything unless it served his own purposes. This must have been a slip of the tongue unless he wanted Alex to know something. Alex had accepted Brian's reasoning behind his brother's disappearance, but Wiles' seemingly offhanded remark now opened a line of doubt. What does Wiles know? Wiles dismissively waved a hand. "Don't worry about it," he said. "Forget I said that. You need to keep that shit between us." Alex decided to push the comment out of his mind and unsuccessfully attempted to bat the ball out of Wiles' hand. Wiles yanked the ball out of reach just in time, attempting to spin past, but Alex stayed with Wiles all the way to the basket. Wiles pushed him back to create some space, then teardropped a fadeaway shot that arced over Alex's head and swished right into the basket. "That's another foul, dude. You can't push off on me like that." Wiles charged within striking distance, his face inches from Alex's face. "You better stop calling fouls on me. Quit whining like a little bitch. I always do whatever it takes to win. You need to learn that shit and start acting like a man." Wiles' sudden, harsh castigation of Alex awakened a twinge of guilt for the secret he carried. The decision about whether or not to tell Wiles had not been an easy one. He wanted to be a man that Wiles could count on, but regardless of how stupid Brian had been to sleep with Megan, he probably did not deserve the punishment he would get from Wiles if, when, he found out. Or perhaps Brian deserved it. Alex kept changing his mind. "About Brian, can you do me a favor and keep an eye on him? No big deal. Just let me know if he does anything strange." Yeah, sure," Alex said as he knelt, coughing, an irritation rising up in his lungs and throat. Each violent outburst resulted in tiny blood splatters on the pavement. Wiles came in for a closer look. "That's not good." "I'm fine. I'm getting used to hacking up chunks of things." "You gotta take care of yourself, son. Cut out all that Taco Bell and eat some vegetables and shit. Look at me, I party like a rock star, but I'm out here going all Kobe Bryant on you on this court." Alex walked to the basketball and picked it up. He dribbled it a few times. Each time the ball rose, he pushed down on it, and it touched the ground then bounced back up into his hand, just as expected. Action and reaction. Wiles takes care of me. How can I keep the truth from him like this? He had a sudden urge to tell Wiles what he knew. The secret pressed down on him like a support beam ready to buckle under the pressure of a collapsing building. "There's something you should probably know." "What is it?" "Let me guess, you just found your game." Alex scrutinized the basketball, his fingertips turning white as they gripped the dimpled rubber. "I should tell him." Wiles needs to know if his brother's wife is running around on his brother. I'd like to know, wouldn't I? I'd want to know if the girl I shared a house with was a cheating slut. But if I do that, then what happens to Brian? The scenarios and prospective outcomes overwhelmed him, so he tabled any further decisions until he could give this some more thought. He relaxed his grip on the ball and faked a pale smile. It's nothing. Don't worry about it. You want to see the game? I've just been warming up so far. Now it's time to get real. That's what I'm talking about. Bring it then. Alex drove his Jeep into the spacious alley behind 24-Hour Fitness on Baseline Street. He thought it a strange place to meet, but Wiles had insisted. On a closed dumpster, the man who must be Alex's contact sat, swinging his legs and hitting the dumpster with his heels. Bang, bang. It seemed quite a powerful clamor for someone supposedly doing a drug deal. Alex exited his car and called out to the man. Are you Theo? The guy waved at him, beckoning Alex forward, still banging his heels. Could you make any more noise? Alex said, looking around. With all of Wiles' castigations about his own carelessness, Alex could not believe the level of thoughtlessness his contact displayed. Theo jumped down from the dumpster and approached Alex. Theo was a small, squatty Hispanic man with beady eyes and a pronounced underbite. Alex thought he looked like a bulldog. Don't worry about it, Holmes. Ain't nobody back here. Make all the noise we want. What you got from me? I only brought a teener. Sorry, but that's all I got at the moment. Theo's beady eyes turned even beadier. Supposed to bring an ounce, not a fucking 16th. What can I do with that? I can't split that up for shit. Barely get high off that. Are you joking? This is the real deal. It hasn't been stepped on or anything. You can cut it as much as you want. If you can't get high off a 16th, then I don't know what kind of shit you're putting up your nose before, but it's a saying, guy. I don't mean it for real. Theo put a hand against his face and tapped a finger against his cheek. Quite contemplative. All right, then, let me see it. Alex produced the little baggie of yellow powder. Theo flicked at it with a finger. You shitting me? That's not even a teener. I don't know what you're trying to pull, but Miguel gonna kick my ass if I bring back some bullshit like this. Miguel? Wiles habitually left out key bits of information such as that, and Alex now realized the purpose of this meeting. For as much shit as Wiles talked about Miguel and his crew, they sure did a lot of business together. Made no sense to Alex. He would not allow people he disliked in his circles if he were making the decisions. Look, dude, you didn't get me out here for nothing. You wanted some crystal? Here it is. Can we just do this? I need to get home, and I don't want to stand out here fucking with you all day long. Theo moved back and eased his hand into his pocket where it remained. Gun? Knife? Alex did not take his eyes off that pocket. That's it. We done here. I'm not interested, so I ain't got no use for you anymore. Go run on back to Wiles, Theo said. It would have been easy for Alex to pack it up, turn around, and get into his Jeep. However, something about the smug little expression on this guy's rotund face and his slimy condescension filled Alex with ire. He knew he had to make a choice. He did not want to start a fight, but he had no desire to look like a chump either. No. You're going to give me the cash, and I'm going to give you this meth. That's what we came out here for. Now let's just do it. I'm not leaving empty-handed. You deaf, little man? I said get back into your car and leave. Little man. Alex probably had 30 pounds on this squatty bulldog. For several seconds, neither said or did anything. Alex stood firm, unwilling to back down first. Theo jerked and revealed his hand, now gripping a roll of quarters. Alex instantly reacted and jabbed Theo in the mouth. Theo took a step back, his free hand rushing to his face as some blood dribbled down his fingers. Alex balled his fists and waited for Theo to do something. Theo reared back to dive at Alex, but telegraphed his move and Alex easily sidestepped him. As the bulldog lunged, Alex smacked him on the back of the head. Theo hit the pavement face first. Alex bounced around with his fist raised like a boxer ready for more, but Theo did not get up. He spat blood on the ground. Alex leaned over him, gloating. Punk bitch, he said, and then walked away. That was a big mistake, Theo yelled after him. Me and my boys are not people you want to fuck with. Alex, full of adrenaline, hopped into his Jeep, lit up a cigarette, and started the car, victorious. Not counting the night he pushed Brian up against the wall, this had been his first ever fight. All right. So that was actually pretty good, right? I mean, that was a pretty decent chapter. There was some good tension in there. It wasn't a whole lot of just boring exposition-y blah, blah, blah. There was actually, you know, some movement in that chapter. Some interesting stuff happened and some pretty good tension. So let's go back and unpack it, right? Right, let's do this. So once again, we start in media res. We start off with wheezing, coughing, inability to catch his breath. They had played only 5 minutes. Now, another way I could have done this, and this might have been more interesting, I don't know, I just kind of thought of it now. But instead of saying that, leaving out that last part, they had played only 5 minutes, to delay where they are for another sentence or two. Maybe start off the chapter with, you know, Alex was wheezing, coughing, he couldn't catch his breath, his heart pounded in his chest, sweat dripped down the side of his face. Because then, you know, we're in so media res, we don't know what's going on. We don't know if Alex is in a fight, we don't know if he's skiing or playing basketball, or if he's afraid for his life. You know, that might have been a little bit more exciting, because we find out, you know, you don't want to go too long. I've talked about this several times before. You don't want to go too long into a chapter without explaining who the POV character is, where you are, and what's going on. But delaying that for another sentence might have made it a little more exciting. Anyway, so we do find out pretty soon at the beginning of the second sentence that where Alex and Wilds had gone to the court. We don't know which court, but we have to assume it's a basketball court. And also, we don't know whether they're inside or outside, because there is, aside from this chapter, is almost entirely dialogue and action about the basketball. Now, I don't think that this chapter needs a paragraphs-long description about the trees that line the side of the outdoor basketball court, but a couple sentences here and there wouldn't have hurt. Because I think when I wrote this, my intention was that they were outside, but you don't know that. They could be in some high school gym somewhere playing inside. We don't know if there are more than one basketball court and there are other people. So we don't get any sensory details about the sights, the sounds, the smells of anything else that's going on outside of this. Now, as kind of a white room way to write this, it works pretty well. But it wouldn't have hurt to include more details. Anyway, I'll stop talking about that because I think I've made my point several times over, and you guys are probably getting tired of hearing it. So let's move on. We get a little bit of background about Alex playing high school basketball. Now, normally this kind of exposition wouldn't matter and doesn't really advance the plot, you know, knowing that Alex played point guard. But there is one part of this that I do like, where it said that he led his team to the state championships despite never trying exceptionally hard. And that's one thing that I've tried to get across about Alex's character, is that he's one of those people who tends to succeed no matter what he does, without trying very hard. And there's a specific kind of person, I'm sure everybody knows that kind of person, that they just seem to like find success in life and without really trying. And it's a very specific kind of person. And I'll leave you to make your own conclusions about that. Then we get this conversation about the last time Alex had some exercise. And you might have noticed I said, "You're dripping with sweat, Britton," is what Wiles says. Because if you remember, Wiles refers to people by their last names, except a little bit later on in the chapter, Wiles doesn't do that. And he talks about Brian by name instead of calling Brian Connolly. So there's a bit of a characterization inconsistency there. Alex tells the story about hooking up with the brunette with the glasses, but then it's kind of interesting because he says, you know, "I hooked up with this girl." Then immediately after, it says he did not actually hook up with the brunette with the glasses. So I've talked before about how Alex is a compulsive liar. Now, this is okay for Alex to say this, and for then his interior monologue or the POV description to directly conflict with that, but it might have been better for Wiles to catch him in a lie, because then that would have been some nice tension. It would have given Alex a chance to either get honest about it, which would demonstrate his loyalty to Wiles, or maybe to try to cover it up more, which might demonstrate his insecurity about not having sex with this girl or whatever. But it's kind of a little bit of a missed opportunity there. So then we get into them playing, and there's a lot of description of basketball here in this chapter, a lot of actual the mechanics of basketball, and I think for the most part it works pretty well. We have pretty good descriptions here that do paint a pretty nice picture of the game between them. And it's in kind of an interesting dynamic, because what we have in this chapter is Wiles is clearly better than Alex at basketball. And a couple of times in this chapter, Alex calls a foul on Wiles, which eventually leads to Wiles blowing up at Alex, and it turns into kind of a life lesson. So as a metaphor for the dynamic between Alex and Wiles, I think the them playing basketball works pretty well. I mean, it definitely works a lot better than if they were having this conversation in this chapter sitting on a couch pulling bong hits, because here we're showing the relationship between them. And I read in a book by, I think it was by K.M. Weiland, a book about, maybe it was Outlining Your Novel or something, where she talked about having motion in your scenes, and I really like that. You have to be extremely skilled to pull off well a chapter where two people sit in a room and talk. Anytime you add motion to your chapter where people are doing something and you describe it enough that the reader gets a sense of motion, you know, even like a good example is on what was the name of that show? The West Wing, where they did the, you know, where Aaron Sorkin, he invented the walk and talk. Now, like, just the fact that people are walking didn't make those scenes more exciting, but it was just kind of this idea that the motion in the scene gives your eye something to do. Well, it still works in a book. Having motion in a scene engages the reader's imagination, at least this is my theory. Anyway, so as they're playing basketball, Alex is grunting, you know, because he doesn't get any exercise. He spends all his time just, like, drinking, smoking, and doing meth. So then Wiles turns the conversation to Brian, and this is good because it gets to it pretty soon. You know, it's not like 6 pages of playing basketball. It's just about a page and a half of basketball to set up where we are and what's going on. Then Wiles turns the conversation to Brian. You know, he says, like, has he done anything weird? Because I'm trying to demonstrate that Wiles doesn't trust Brian, that Wiles might think that maybe Brian is a snitch or something like that, because he's saying, you know, like, had anybody over you don't recognize? Does he leave the room when he gets a phone call? So we don't know exactly why Wiles is motivated to ask these questions, but we get the impression that he definitely doesn't trust Brian. And Alex is saying, you know, no, I told you, dude. And the dialogue differentiation between Wiles saying son and Alex saying dude works, you know, pretty well for the most part, because there's not a whole lot of dialogue attribution in this chapter. And even though the dialogue isn't greatly differentiated, the addition of dude and son works pretty well to do that. So then we get our nugget of information on the Jimmy Connolly subplot, Brian's little brother, because Wiles says Jimmy Connolly didn't run away. I know exactly where he is. Now, we know from a few chapters ago when Miguel was reminiscing that Jimmy had something to do, or, you know, Miguel said he knew what happened to Jimmy. So now we learn that Wiles knows where he is. So this then throws more shade on Brian's theory that Jimmy ran away to Utah, because Wiles seems to think that, or at least Wiles is claiming, he knows where Jimmy Connolly is and that he didn't run away. So in terms of that subplot, I think it's coming along pretty nicely. We're getting little nuggets of information about it here and there. And especially because we don't know if we can trust Wiles to tell the truth. Like, Alex is mostly out of the loop with this Jimmy stuff. And there's some good reflection here when he says that, because even though the POV is pretty distant, like, Alex did not know how to interpret this statement. Wiles never offered insight to anything unless it served his own purposes. So Alex is wondering if Wiles said this about Jimmy because he wanted to implant an idea in his head. This works really well because we get a bit of exposition, But because Alex doesn't know what to do with it, the reader won't know what to do with it. So that actually works pretty well. Then we have a little bit more basketball. Alex claims another foul because Wiles pushes off on him. And then we have the result of Alex calling fouls is that Wiles gets in his face, and Wiles treats it like a life lesson. You know, quit whining like a bitch. I do what it takes to win. You need to learn that and start acting like a man. And then we have a line here that says, Wiles' sudden, harsh castigation of Alex. Now, a couple weeks ago, I think, I was talking about word space, where you can use a word like the, and, or said, you know, basic words like that 20 times on a page and no one bats an eye. But a word like castigation is such a unique kind of 50-cent word that, if you might remember during the reading, it occurs in this after the scene break. And so having that word castigation only like three pages apart, that's going to stick out to a reader. That's the kind of thing probably that your editor will catch, or your beta readers might or might not catch it. Or I catch a lot of those when I do the final step of my editing process, the last thing I do before I release the book. When I sit down with my MacBook and I have it read the entire book to me, I find a lot of those where I've used a word and then three sentences later I use it again. So now we finally get Alex is because Wiles is like, you need to act like a man. This sets up this interior conflict in Alex that he's not sure if he should tell Wiles what he knows about Brian and Megan. Now, it might have been a little more interesting and compelling to make this chapter that Alex had been worrying about that from the beginning, but it's okay that it comes up here, because it's Wiles unknowingly makes Alex worry about this. Now, I talked before in the chapter where Alex hunted down Brian with the paintball gun, where Alex was like, I'm not going to tell Wiles, and I said, you know, that kind of ruined a chance for conflict. But the way that it's structured in the story is Alex thinks, I'm not going to tell him, and then now that Wiles is yelling at Alex for calling fouls on him playing basketball, it brings it up again in him. Now, again, it might have been better just to have that undercurrent of tension running through it the whole time, but it still kind of works this way. So Wiles is saying, keep an eye on Brian for me, and Alex is like, yeah, yeah, whatever. And then he's spitting blood. He's coughing blood on the pavement. So this is trying to demonstrate that Alex his health is failing because of all the drugs he's doing. You know, he's a young man. He's only 21 years old. If you remember a few chapters ago, six or eight chapters ago, we saw Alex's 21st birthday. So we know he's a young man. But he's into the drugs so much that it's causing his health to fail. And he talks about hacking up chunks of things, which is pretty gross. And then we have another line here where Wiles is like, cut out the Taco Bell and eat some vegetables. Because Wiles is mentoring Alex now. And we have a line here, or a paragraph that I think is pretty interesting, where Alex picks up the basketball, he dribbles it, he's watching it bounce, and he compares the way that every time he pushes down on the basketball that it hits the ground and comes back up to life in general. Because if you remember, one of the major differences between Brian and Alex is how Brian views the world as fluid and Alex views the world as action and reaction. And so Alex interprets this to think, you know, Wiles is taking care of me and I'm lying to him. Action and reaction, that it's not right what he's doing. And then we have the big tension of the chapter where Alex almost tells Wiles about Brian. Now, it might have been better if we had ended the chapter before Alex made the decision not to tell Wiles about it. That could have been a pretty interesting cliffhanger. But the fact that right after this scene, we go into a scene where Alex goes to meet Theo, it would kind of spoil that if like he left it as a cliffhanger and then we didn't talk about whether or not he told Wiles in the next scene, because the reader would be like, what happened? What happened? Why isn't Alex thinking about what he said to Wiles? But then we have the scene break and we move on to the next scene where Alex goes to meet Theo. And of course, you remember that Theo is Miguel's boy. And so he goes to meet him to sell some drugs. And so now we have the cross-pollination of Wiles' guy Alex with Miguel's guy Theo. And so it looks like we're setting up maybe a war between those two factions, between Miguel and Wiles, or we're setting up something because things are starting to cross-pollinate. So I think this works pretty well as a scene just to accomplish that goal, to accomplish the goal of having Alex and Theo cross-pollinate here. It works pretty well. So they meet, and for whatever reason, Alex is there to sell Theo some meth, but he didn't bring as much as Theo was expecting. So we have some tension between them, some argument. Alex looks at... there's a pretty good description here. I like this. Theo was a small, squatty Hispanic man with beady eyes and a pronounced underbite. Alex thought he looked like a bulldog. That really paints a vivid image of what Theo looks like, doesn't it? And so this argument between them escalates, and the way that Theo has this kind of interesting way of talking and that he usually leaves off the subject, like he doesn't start his sentences with I when he's talking about himself, like don't mean it for real. And it's pretty good dialogue differentiation, even though it's kind of stereotypical of Theo, the way that it's written. But so we see things escalating between them until Theo says something about Miguel. And now Alex is surprised because he didn't know that this guy he was going to meet, Theo, works for Miguel. And so there's mention here about Wiles leaving out key bits of information. And it says Alex realized the purpose of this meeting. But it doesn't tell the reader what the purpose of this meeting is. So it's kind of strangely written. It's like Alex realizes the purpose. What that purpose is, we don't know. But then there's reference to how Wiles and Miguel do a lot of business together, which Alex doesn't understand because he wouldn't allow people he dislikes into his circles. So then the conversation escalates more. Theo puts his hand in his pocket. Then they fight, and Alex punches him. And the way that this chapter ends is really interesting because it says that aside from the time he pushed Brian, this is his first ever fight, but we're seeing Alex kind of, maybe you might look at it as overcompensating because he's standing over Theo and he's like, you punk bitch. So Alex is all full of adrenaline, and we're really seeing Alex going from the kind of person who would talk about getting into fights and talk about getting laid to being the kind of person who is now actually getting in fights. He pushed Brian, now he punched Theo. And so we're seeing this real progression of, if you think about it, maybe 10 chapters ago when Wiles drove Alex to the trailer park and that man slapped his wife outside the trailer and how shocked Alex was. If you think about the progression from there to where Alex is now punching dudes and standing over them gloating about it and calling them punk bitch, we've seen Alex is actually changing. And so in that respect, Alex's character arc actually works pretty well because it's being shown. We're not talking about how different Alex is. We're seeing it in these episodes. Like I've talked before about plotting character arcs and how, you know, you have a line and you plot points on that line where things are going to happen that show how a character has changed. In terms, in that respect, this works really well to demonstrate how Alex is different than he used to be. He's no longer wide-eyed and innocent. Now he's actually participating in violence, and he's changing. So that's probably all I have to say about that. Next week is episode 52, and that'll be the one-year anniversary of the show. And that's crazy to think about that. I want to thank everyone for coming along this journey with me. And I hope you're getting something out of it. And I will see you guys next week. Now stay tuned for the song and the guy who talks. That's not me. All right, bye guys.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad. We will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste, so please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com, and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So go on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers, and you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it.